Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Good to hear NPR's Tom Goldman spending 40 seconds or so talking up Michigan State to the whole country. We want to wish the Spartans luck as we take the floor at the dance this afternoon. Delaware is 25-9. That's a record to inspire some confidence there. We're 26-8. TNT airs it at 4:40 this afternoon, and CBS and True TV are the other networks airing games at this stage of the tournament. Later on this hour, singer-activist Holly Neer joins us here on Current State. At the top of our program, General Motors officials continue efforts to navigate the fallout from its delayed recall of 1.6 million defective vehicles. The flaw with an ignition switch has been linked to 31 crashes and 12 deaths. It's been traced to vehicles made as long ago as 2001, and it was the subject of communications between GM and the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration as far back as 2007. But the automaker did not issue a recall of the vehicles until late January of this year. That's also the first time that CEO Mary Barra says she was made aware of the issue. Now, on Tuesday, Ms. Barra pledged that such an episode never happens again and took, quote, full responsibility for the work going forward, unquote. In the meantime, General Motors has been named in at least four lawsuits involving the defect, and congressional lawmakers are planning an inquiry to review some of the latest developments. We welcome Detroit Free Press reporter Alisa Priddle, who's been writing about the episode. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
You wrote that CEO Mary Barra wants to usher in a new era of quick response and accountability on her watch. How serious an acknowledgement of major problems in GM was that comment?
Well, I think it was a major problem. When we met with her on Tuesday, this was the first time that she sat down with media for us to pass on to the public, I think, some of her frank answers to a lot of the questions around this. But by then, that was about the fourth time that she had apologized in some respect. She had done it in a video to employees. She'd done it in a number of ways. So, you know, I do feel that this is a top priority for her. I mean, this is in keeping with her management style. If she wants a company that's more transparent and reactive to consumers, I don't think she thought that the first thing on her desk would be doing it in the context of a recall that's had all this tragic results.
It is a baptism under fire, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And this is a woman who, you know, because she is the first female CEO of a major automaker, there has been all kinds of eyes on her anyway to see how will she manage, how will she adapt culture, how will she get along with the rest of her team. And so certainly then add to that a very high-profile recall. She is definitely being scrutinized for every move that she makes.
Is it at all clear at this point how this happened? And what Ms. Barra will need to do to be sure this never happens again?
Well, we also were talking to Mark Royce, who is the product chief. And then one of the questions was, you know, how is it possible that the CEO didn't know about this until last year, particularly since both Mary Barra and Mark Royce have come up through the product development ranks and have probably been in a number of positions through their careers as they advance to touch this. One of the things Royce said was that, well, first off, when there is an idea that there's a problem, there's a technical team that then starts delving into data to see if there's a problem. And so you don't tell the CEO every time you're investigating something. You have to let them do their work. So that's one of their stances. But the other, I mean, I think we are all slightly baffled that there could be records of a potential problem going back so far, all the way to when they were engineering the Saturn Ion back in 2001, and there were indications on the engineering side that there might be a problem with this ignition switch. And for those who just need a recap of what the problem is, they're saying that, you know, when you put your key in the ignition, and it's in the on position with a heavy laden keychain, it can sometimes slip down, maybe if you hit, especially if you get jostled on a pothole or something, and it can slip into the accessory mode. And once that happens, then you can lose your power steering, and in the event of a crash, your airbags aren't going to go off. And that's what the problem is. And so there seemed to have been some indication that it wasn't a robust switch in the first place, but it's gone through all of these years and so many vehicles. You have to remember something like the Chevy Cobalt, hugely popular small car because it was affordable entry-level car, and all of its kind of stable mates that were, you know, that size of vehicle from GM. So tons of them on the road, kind of, I guess, a low-key thing you think of your ignition, but for whatever reason, the occasional problems people were reporting with these, it didn't somehow add up to that there was a series of events that could have these tragic results, and it was something that was repeatable, that more people were going to die because of this.
Right. We'll also point out that, Mary Barra has also maintained that the cars that are being recalled work normally when there is nothing else on the key, when all you do is use the key itself and there's nothing else exerting pressure pulling it down. We'll also point out that none of the vehicles being recalled are still in production. Alisa, will the investigations then, will they focus on who knew what when? Is it going to play out that way?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is, because there is sort of a paper trail of, you know, different people from different places noticing a problem. So they want to pinpoint at what point should, you know, both the government safety machine and the automakers, I mean, you know, you have to put some onus on both sides, but at what point should all of these smart minds in these different places have realized this is something that has to be addressed with, you know, with an action, with a recall, with a fix? You know, this can't be a piecemeal thing at all. And it's particularly poignant right now because yesterday we got the news about Toyota getting that $1.2 billion penalty.
Yes.
Because they did not take the proper steps and take seriously enough safety concerns. So it is top of mind in this country right now that you do not err on the side of not alerting people to safety issues.
Did we learn anything that may impact GM from the Toyota fine?
Well, we learned that there can be very, very harsh penalties, that there is no tolerance right now for knowing information and not passing it on, or for in any way trying to deceive the public or the government agencies that are acting on the public's behalf. Toyota was slapped very, very hard on the wrist. And even when Toyota was even called into congressional hearings back in the 2009-2010 timeframe when its recalls were going on, even that sent a chill through the auto industry. And we started to see automakers announcing recalls for everything possible. It was really a period of when in doubt, issue a recall or some kind of service notice, because nobody wanted to be seen as erring on the wrong side of caution.
Mm-hmm.
And then this just brings it home one more time and shows that there is a huge penalty to be paid, and there's zero tolerance for this kind of activity. And so GM's got to be looking at this saying, okay, this could be expensive, this could be, you know, brand shattering, this could be a lack of public trust. All of these things can happen.
We're talking with Alisa Priddle of the Detroit Free Press about the GM vehicle recall and the aftermath of its delayed recall of its various defective vehicles. Clarify for us again, though, Alisa, when does Mary Barra claim to have found out about the defect?
She says that she found out in late December that there was a problem with ignition switches, and that she got a call from Mark Royce, I think around January 31st, that the teams were going to order a recall. So that's very, very recent.
Okay. Now, in her remarks on Tuesday, you wrote that CEO Barra stopped short of accepting responsibility for accidents and deaths that occurred before GM emerged from bankruptcy in 2009. Put that in a little bit more context for us, please. What makes the bankruptcy relevant here?
The reason it's relevant is that oftentimes what happens in bankruptcy, the whole point of bankruptcy is to shed liability. And in the case of the automakers, if you may recall, there were terms like old GM and new GM. And what they said was that GM went into bankruptcy, and at the time it had all kinds, it had pending lawsuits on all kinds of fronts, everything from a slip and fall to probably an ignition switch related accident. Of course, that was before the recall, so they weren't aware, you know, of this whole chain of events. But either way, there were all these liabilities. And what happened is that coming out of bankruptcy, a new GM, a new entity was formed, but it didn't bring with it a lot of what they call their bad assets. And so it meant they were sort of free of all of those past liabilities. And so going forward, Mary is saying, you know, we want to do right by our customers and you know, we're going to look after everyone. But these old liabilities, you know, there's an immunity shield there that we are not responsible for those. And there is a call by some to say you should be looking after these victims. And there are some lawsuits about to be filed that are going to say we now see documentation that you knew that there was a problem as far back as 2001. So how can you not bring the liability for crashes because of that forward? And she is saying at this point, we are not going to bring that liability forward. I also asked her if she was going to put together some kind of a victims fund or something for these people. And she said at this point, no. I asked her if she was even considering it. And again, she's saying, all she said was, we will do right by our customers, which maybe we can read into it that she is going to consider some kind of victims fund going forward, or maybe she's just going to stand behind the law that says this is not new GM's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Now, CEO Barra says she expects to testify before Congress about this. Have you learned anything so far today as to when that might start?
This week, there were supposed to be meetings between congressional staff and GM staff, and so she thought that by the end of this week, they would have a better idea of the dates, but her best guess is probably maybe the first week of April. And when we asked her, did she expect to testify, she said she fully expects that she will be called to testify. She will be the face of GM on this. You know, there will likely be other people, but she fully expects to be there on the stand and take the questions on what happened.
One final question here, Alisa. What role did federal regulators play in this, if that's at all clear? Is there anything to suggest that federal regulators dropped the ball here as well?
Well, I think so, because the documentation shows that they alerted GM to a potential problem back in 2007. So that is 7 years ago. So and they are the ones who are the gatherers of the complaints, and they're the ones who, when complaints reach a critical mass, or you know, or even there's just a few of them, but it's deemed so serious that people need to act, that's their job to say to the automaker, because the automaker isn't always the one that gets the complaints and hears about all of the problems. Sometimes people just go through the safety side. So I do think that some responsibility falls on NHTSA to have pressed it further. I don't think that all the blame should fall just on GM. I think they share it.
We want to thank Detroit Free Press reporter Alisa Priddle, who's been writing about the the botched GM recall. Alisa, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And welcome to WKAR's spring fundraising campaign here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore, your Monday through Friday host here on Current State, along with show producer Joe Lindstroth. We're asking you to get on the phone right now and call 517-353-5000. Demonstrate your support for this program and everything that else that you hear on WKAR. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Mark. That's right, 517-353-5000 or WKAR.org. We could use your support, whether you listen a little or a lot or just a short time or... From the beginning, we know that public radio is an important part of your life. In fact, we know you're listening because now you're listening. A lot of you folks may have discovered WKAR, perhaps rediscovered WKAR through Current State over the last year. We just had our one-year anniversary about a month ago. And we know our research says that, you know, it takes about a year, 2 years for folks to, when they start listening to public radio, kind of get the gist of how things work, that it's, you know, we actually come to you twice a year for support. It takes a few times to hear us babble on the radio before maybe you actually pick up the phone, go to the computer, and pledge your support. We're asking you maybe if it's just been a year, you can buck those trends and maybe give us... some of your hard-earned dollars a little bit earlier than maybe some of the research shows, because you do rely on Current State for getting your local news, getting in-depth and context and what actually affects your lives here. Give us a call, 517-353-5000 or WKR.org. Give now. Link, you don't even have to talk to anyone. You can just click a few buttons and give that way, right, Mark?
That's right. 517-353-5000 or WKAR.org. You know, after 4 hours of Morning Edition and all the great journalism that you get to start out every morning from 5 till 9 on 90.5 FM, Current State, obviously we tighten the focus a little bit. We focus on what's going on in our state, and oftentimes we'll focus even tighter. We'll focus on East Lansing or, you know, the mid-Michigan area. It is programming that's important to you. We've spoken to so many of you in the past 14 months or so who say, we love what you're doing. Keep it up. Now is the time. Now is an important time to demonstrate your financial support for what we're doing, because it does take dollars. 517-353-5000. Please contribute. We're not necessarily asking for an awful lot of money, but the power of an awful lot of modest contributions really goes a long way. 517-353-5000 or online at WKAR.org.
That's right, Mark. We ask that you just give what you can. You listen. You put a value on it. That's how this works. Whatever you can afford, whatever you think is appropriate. I ask you to consider that, you know, a newspaper costs, you know, somewhere from $1 to $1.25 a day. That's probably not even close to what most folks would pledge to get their news from Current State or Morning Edition or All Things Considered daily. So if you put that in perspective, you know, give us a call, whatever you can afford, at 517-353-5000 or at WKAR.org at the Give Now link.
WKAR. It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last December, some high-tech Grinches tried to steal Christmas for one major retailer. Computer hackers broke into the Target Corporation's mainframe and downloaded some 40 million credit card numbers. The breach was executed despite the fact that Target had installed malware detection software months before. Today, Michigan State University is hosting its first ever interdisciplinary conference on cybercrime, and Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more about the issue. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
We're just fine.
Great. The Target credit card debacle was really a stunning blow to Target, and it was one of the splashiest hack jobs in recent memory. But really, you don't have to take a deep stare into corporate America to find cybercrime. All too often, it's coming to a mainframe near you. I spoke with Jared Andrews about the variety of viruses that work their way into email servers. Jared is an information technologist here at Michigan State University. He has seen his share of malware in his time. Most of them are minor and repairable annoyances, but occasionally, though, as he tells me, a big one will burst through the filters.
We have had one complete loss of data caused by a virus, or what we call ransomware, called CryptoLocker.
CryptoLocker is a relatively new malware that attacks Microsoft Windows programs. In the cyber world, it's known as a Trojan horse. Anyone connected with Michigan State University can tell you Spartans historically don't get along with Trojans, so Andrews wasted no time trying to defeat it. But he concedes this one could have been much worse were it not for one saving grace.
Luckily, the user had most of their files backed up on an offline backup, and that's how we were able to remedy the situation. We had to completely reload the operating system on the computer.
But this thing eats your files like Pac-Man.
Yes. It happens very quickly, and it happens in the background, and you don't know about it until it's done.
In the 90s, when the web was young, hackers unleashed computer malware for bragging rights and the joy of conquest. Today, though, it's an industry.
There is a tremendous profit motive.
Dr. Tom Holt is an associate professor in MSU's School of Criminal Justice. He says there's a lucrative black market for stolen credit card data.
That information can go for anywhere from $10 to $50 per card. So if you can get your hands on a few thousand cards, you can make a substantial amount of money.
Holt's study focuses largely on how hacker communities are structured. He says most are not contractors, but rather lone entrepreneurs who know the avenues to make a sale. Another tidbit, most known hackers have ties to Russia and Eastern Europe. And Holt says political chaos tends to trigger computer crime.
When these real-world events take place, there is an offshoot of cyber attacks that occur between hackers in different countries. In fact, with the recent events in Ukraine and Russia, we've seen some hackers who are posting this kind of data as revenge against the U.S.
Just as upstanding people go shopping online, hackers have their hangouts too. These are encrypted websites complete with login screens and passwords that give access to the underground. In cyber lingo, stolen credit card markets are referred to as dumps. Hackers post their ill-gotten data on online forums. Holt says they're driven by customer feedback in much the same way as Amazon or eBay. And while it's said there's no honor among thieves, there is a business protocol. Forum administrators stand guard over the comments, watching out for disreputable players called rippers. Holt says even here, good is rewarded and bad is rejected.
And so if someone comes in and says, this data is great, I was able to get this amount of money from these accounts, the seller gave me everything really quickly, that kind of positive feedback means that that person's going to get elevated in the forum. The people who say, for instance, that I sent the guy my money and he never sent me the product, or it's been a week and I've not heard from him, those kinds of negative reviews are what lead a person to get sort of pushed down in the market. So there's a definite dynamic there.
But cybercrime is more than a violation of personal property. It's a violation of the person themselves. And this side of it covers everything from cyberbullying and stalking to child pornography. In Michigan, the state police are at the forefront of that fight. First Lieutenant James Ellis commands MC3, the Michigan Cyber Command Center. His unit gets computer crime tips from a lot of sources, mainly local internet service providers and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The MSP headquarters in Lansing is also the regional office for the agency Internet Crimes Against Children. Ellis says the whole team has a lot on its plate.
We have 55 affiliate agencies that work in our offices throughout Michigan, and they are overwhelmed with investigations.
Ellis says in cases of child exploitation, police will first look for photographic evidence. It can be hard to find the smoking gun when a potential suspect erases their hard drive or simply denies their involvement. That's when MC3 digs deeper to find traces of cybercrime. Ellis leads me to a small room with shelf after shelf of confiscated hardware.
The room we happen to be in now is our property room, and most of the equipment you're looking at is waiting to be analyzed or investigated or examined. There's almost any type of digital technology that you can think of in this room, from computers, including towers, laptops, tablets, phones, SD cards. I mean, you name it, it is in this room someplace.
Lieutenant Ellis has served 21 years with the Michigan State Police, nearly as long as the internet itself has existed. 3 of those years have been with the Cyber Command Center. But even in that short period, Ellis says he's seen a huge evolution in technology that's made cybercrime increasingly difficult to track.
Did we imagine it would get this way? I certainly don't think so, and I think we're only scratching the surface in what we're seeing today.
Experts admit the scope of cybercrime is so large that it's hard for the good guys to make a real dent. But there are some basic precautions that can reduce your risk of being victimized. Watch for email addresses that don't look quite right. You may receive regular messages from your bank, for example, but be aware of even the tiniest variations that don't look legitimate. Don't open messages that appear to come from family and friends, but whose subject lines don't seem like something that person would send to you. And never respond to suspicious messages asking you to verify your username and password. These are classic tactics of a phishing expedition, but a little vigilance will help you dodge the spear. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore along with Joe Lindstroth, Current State producer here for our day one for us of our spring fundraising campaign. It's your opportunity to make an investment, an important investment in local news, community dialogue, and awareness of what's happening here in mid-Michigan and beyond. Please call right now and make your pledge at 517-353-5000. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. You know, we were doing a bit of a calculation not long ago after we hit the one-year mark, and I believe it was our station manager, Peter Wharf, came up with a pretty astounding number that in just over a year, current state, has given you listeners, WKR listeners, over 800 different conversations or segments. 800 in 1 year. If even a fraction of those you found value in, as you listen to our show over the last year, give us a call at 517-353-5000 or at WKAR.org. Once again, more than 800 individual segments and conversations about the Lansing community, Michigan, mid-Michigan, that were not here over a year ago. Mm. That's a lot of content. And if I do say, folks, that we are doing a lot with a little. With 800 segments, we have a lot more ideas. There are a lot of the things that we can't get to because we are constrained by resources, because we just don't have the manpower and the financial resources to do different series, to do more investigative work, to bring you even more great content from this amazing community here in mid-Michigan. 800, we want to double it, and we want to make it better, but we need your help. 517-353-5000 or at WKAR.org at the Give Now link. Please.
If you've listened on a regular basis or a semi-regular basis at all, you've learned that here on Current State, you hear about people and places and ideas and subjects, many of which matter to you, stories that you count on and others that you may not have been aware of until you learned about them on the program. Your financial support of WKAR makes this possible. Please call and make your gift today. Phone 517-353-5000. Again, it's very easy online as well at WKAR.org. Current State, we've been at it just over a year, as Joe points out, and we want to keep evolving the show. You do play a role in that. 517-353-5000 with whatever you can afford for Current State and everything else that you hear here on WKAR.
You know, I think public radio, Mark, is kind of is that quality thing, that thing that I think you go a little extra for. If you want to get that extra burger with you know, the prime beef, if you want to go and see the play with the wonderful actors, you have to drive a little bit further. You have to go spend a little bit extra money to get that taste of that burger, mm-hmm. that extra thing. I think that's what public radio is. It brings you context and depth that you can't get anywhere else. The quality is just unmatched. But you do have to go a little bit extra in order to support it. A little bit out of your way just to do a little bit more to get a lot more in return. And that's kind of how this works. And that's what we're asking you to do, is just pick up that phone and call 517-353-5000. We have lovely volunteers. They are not too intrusive, but if you don't want to talk to anyone, it's easy to go at WKAR.org and click on the Give Now link, because we do think you're out there. We do think that folks right now who are listening and have been listening to WKAR, whether it's Morning Edition and Melissa Benmark, or you know, All Things Considered with Brad Walker and the national content, or here at Current State, we know you're listening, and we know you do value quality. And we know that you do understand that that quality actually requires a little bit of effort on your part in order to make it happen. So please give us a call at 517-353-5000 or at WKAR.org.
Every day we try to put together a show that covers a lot of different bases, too. I mean, earlier we heard a Detroit Free Press reporter who did a great job updating us on the GM recall. We're about to hear a segment about the great musician activist Holly Neer coming up in just a little bit. It's that kind of variety and diversity that we put out there for you every day, three times a day here on WKAR. Assign a value to that, please, and call us now with whatever you can afford. 517-353-5000. Again, online, go to WKAR.org, and thanks. March is Women's History Month, and a pioneer of the women's movement will be in town here on Friday. I already kind of spilled the beans here on who we're going to be talking about, but Melissa Benmark, remind our listeners about Holly Neer.
Well, Holly Neer has been combining music and activism since the 1960s. She'll be at the 10 Pound Fiddle this Friday night. And I have to say that talking to her on the phone, she was one of the most thoughtful and kind-sounding people I think I've ever talked to before. And I've talked to a great deal of thoughtful and kind people. She's noted for her anti-war and pro-feminist activism. But when I talked to her earlier this week, we actually had to start out with a very much lesser-known Holly Neer fact. She actually got her start in television in the 1970s.
In my first year at UCLA, I was seen by agents who tend to come over and watch the new crop of actors that are coming up from USC and UCLA and the surrounding colleges, and I got a job in a film. So I left school, which I would not necessarily advise to any young people who are listening to this program, to go and do this film. And then it just sort of began to spin. I did quite a few films, several television shows, including The Partridge Family and All in the Family, Room 222, later on L.A. Law. And then I did films, and I went to New York and did a stint on Broadway in the musical Hair. So that was kind of between the time I was 18, 19, 20. And then I began singing in clubs around Los Angeles. And I got an incredible opportunity to go on an anti-war tour. We were resisting the war that was being waged against Indochina. And I got to be a singer in this tour, an actor and dancer. And that really got me interested in the ways in which music, art, culture can have a voice in the world. And I was very drawn into this world of social consciousness and art and music. So it took me away from Hollywood.
You don't sound too unhappy about that, though.
Well, every once in a while when I watch the Academy Awards, I get a little twinge of, oh, gee, what would have happened if I had stayed and really trained as an actor? Because they all look like they're having lots of fun. And there are things one can do with fame and fortune. Certainly, you look at Matt Damon and various actors who have taken their immense wealth and put it to good work. So every once in a while, I think, I wonder how it would have gone if I made a different choice. But I have had an amazing life, not one that I could even have imagined when I was a child. And so it's curiosity to look at the other choices, but not with regret.
You're very strongly identified with social justice music, and so many sources will say, you know, you're one of the mothers of women's music. How do you feel about those labels?
Oh, I'm honored to be labeled. You know, that people actually know enough about my work to have a name it's extraordinary as an artist to be identified with ideas. And so I feel very honored about that. It's always been a challenge for me as an artist to try to figure out how to do songs that are about something without them being rhetorical or boring, because we've all listened to a boring political song, and it can be deadly. And I got better at it. When I first started out, I was much more rhetorical. And I think now that mixture of sensibility and experience and poetry and humor and entertainment has all really come together in a way that I feel very good about. And I love that there are people in the peace movement or the women's movement or the gay and lesbian movement that really identify me as a voice that has been of use to them. And that's I love that.
I saw at least one recording at the Michigan Women's Festival. How many times have you been here? Do you know?
Oh, I think I've gone. I was at the first one.
No kidding.
30, so I don't know how many years has it been going on, since 75 or
yeah.
something. I don't know.
Yeah,
I went
like
to
that.
The first, second, and probably more regularly at the beginning, and then at least every 3 to 5 years, I'll go. And of course, I've been to Ann Arbor many times over at the Art, and I'm really happy to be coming to the 10 Pound Fiddle to come help you all welcome in spring.
we cannot promise that the weather will act accordingly, because this
I
is...
know, but we can call. I would love for everybody to come and hang out and be part of the event. It's hard to talk about one's own music without sounding like you're blowing your own horn, but the fact of the matter is that people have such a good time. They enjoy seeing each other. There's a lot of singing along, as well as some very artistic moments that and the audience goes very silent for, and it's beautiful. And I love the audience, and I think they have a very good time. It's such a mix of musical theater, sort of cabaret style, to folk music.
You put out around 30 albums, first starting around 1973, and the most recent is from 2012. Do you feel some album pressure at all? That got to put out another one, or at this point, do you kind of get to do what you want, and I have to tour in support of an album?
Well, it's a lovely question. If I were with a, quote, record company, I would have to put out records on a regular basis and tour to support the record. That a record company can't survive without that. And I find it very exhausting. I mean, even though I have my own label and I do my own material, there is that pressure to get the record paid for after you put all your money into it. So I have a self-pressure to do that. I'm concerned about the environment. So I've cut back quite a bit.
Carbon footprint reasons, basically?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I'm trying to make sure that our touring is regional, that I don't, get on a plane and fly, 500 miles this way and 1,000
right.
miles that way, and that we try to keep it as simple as possible. And but it's concerning to me. And the other part is that it's still really important for us to come together and be alive community, to not have everything be digital, because I could be doing these concerts on the web. It's not quite the same, as you know.
Well, and I always end up at some point bringing this up in interviews with musicians, that so much of the listening that we do that's important to us, that forms our musical likes and dislikes and our musical inner map, is done with other people, and or has been traditionally. And I worry that earbuds are making that go away.
Yeah, well, my grandmother probably worried when we moved from the horse and buggy to airplane, so I think there's always concern when we let go of one kind of way of lifestyle to go to another. And I have crossed over into being an elder, and I just don't know what is right for young people now. They're going to have to make those decisions for themselves. And I do worry. But I do think there's something about passing on the torch and trusting that they have the intelligence, the sensitivities, the well-being to figure out what they are going to need for their lives and their children. And I feel like elders who are around and ready to answer questions and be supportive is an important thing, but we're not really in charge anymore, or we shouldn't be.
Which is both terrifying and refreshing.
Yeah, that letting go. It's like parents just letting your children leave the nest and trust that you've done the best you can to give them the tools that they need to make decisions. To me, that was the best thing my parents ever did, was not tell us how to think about a subject, but how to think. It just, how do you take in information and process and say, well, it could go this way or it could go that way, and what's the consequences of the decision? But ultimately, if all you do is pound into a child what they should think, then when they leave home, they haven't learned how to think for themselves. So I feel very grateful to my parents for having given us a lot of room to learn to think. And I made a lot of mistakes, but I also learned how to evaluate my mistakes and get back up and try to do it differently or better next time.
That's interesting you mentioned mistakes, because one of the questions I had wanted to sort of throw out there, a while back I had talked to Janice Ian about being a young musician during the 60s, and she said she felt like really she had been sheltered from a lot of the parts of that era that were more destructive, like the drugs. And you know, that era tends to get glamorized somewhat, but there were a lot of casualties too. And so, as you said, you know, you've crossed into being an elder. How do you look back at that period of time and say, you know, how you made it through that time of upheaval?
Well, I had an angel on my shoulder when it came to drugs, because I was surrounded by them. I tried some of them, and they either made me paranoid, sleepy, or cost too much money, or they cut notes off the top of my range and my ego was too big to let go of my voice. So I feel like I don't know how that happened, but I just say, thank whatever that got me through that without falling prey to, because I have an addict personality and there's addiction in my family, but I made it through that pretty unscarred. And I did see a lot of casualties, and it breaks my heart. I just don't think there's any reason for our culture to support drugs except for people who are in extreme pain and need the assistance of drugs. But as a social thing, I don't know. I don't see the point. I saw so many people die as a result of it. But the mistakes that I made, I'm not sure I could have avoided making them, but I came up at a time where the women's movement and the lesbian movement were trying to re-identify the role of women in contemporary society. And in many ways, we had to lay the bricks down before we stepped on them. Obviously, there have been women who have come before us, but in this contemporary sort of re-blossoming of the women's movement and the development of feminism, we didn't know what we were doing. And we just jumped in with incredible bravery. But oftentimes, we took a lot of people down with us as we went through down that path and made mistakes, hurt people. It was oftentimes a battleground. And if I were going to do it again, I would do it with a great deal more sensitivity and understanding and compassion than I did it at the time. But I think when we do scary things, sometimes we have to go in it like bulldozers, and you know, we mowed down some flowers along the way, and I wish that hadn't happened. But as a result, a lot of people, I don't know if you remember that book called Bridge Calling My Back that women of color wrote, but incredible book, just talking about how you get from one place to another, and sadly sometimes it's on the shoulders of someone else. So a lot of people walked over us and the path that we created to get to where the opportunities that women have today. And one can either look at that and go, ouch, you know, why did you do that? Or you can say, that's great. Somebody had to build this road. And my generation of women really did. So am I sorry we built the road? No. Do I wish we'd done it with more grace? Yes.
That's interesting, because I did want to ask you about that. You know, because much of your activism and your music has been connected to LGBT issues, you know, the last few years have been such a time of activity around issues like same-sex marriage and same-sex adoption. And you've been through civil rights movements before, several of them. What are the themes that you see repeating? What are the universals in these movements of people to be recognized?
Well, there is a common need of all human beings to be able to get up in the morning and live their lives without someone else's foot on their neck. And I don't think there's any than any time in humanity where that didn't exist. But as time has gone on, we've become more skilled or aware that there can actually be social change movements that make change. I think probably back in the 13th century, maybe people didn't know that change was possible in the way we know it now. But the civil rights movement that that came out of the African-American community, the labor movement, the farm workers movement, these various social change movements have educated us on how to proceed. So there are still so many people who are struggling and suffering. They have some examples of how to go forward. So that may be different than from hundreds of years ago. I don't know. I think there's a balance between trying to really go for getting one's own issue put on the agenda and realizing that none of us have a single issue. So how do we make our what might seem a single issue into a global issue? Because I don't think any group can do it by themselves. So within the gay and lesbian transgender community, there are also poor and working class people and people of color. So how can you have a movement about, for example, equality in marriage without also dealing with issues of class and race and internationalism and borders and immigration? And we don't function separate from one another. And so there's where the sophistication, to me, is oftentimes ignored. It's not where movements don't understand. They can't be single issue because none of us live in that kind of isolation or shouldn't. Even the peace movement has to understand that one has to talk to soldiers and returning vets. You can't isolate from that reality.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
I love talking to you. Thank you for calling. And I love that you're keeping radio alive. Radio is such a phenomenal thing. I hope it does not diminish because it's you know, I drive along in my tour, I turn on the radio, and there is some little moment going on, and it's just so exciting, you know, and you make that happen. So,
oh, thank you.
I was doing a radio show somewhere in the middle of the night down in, I think it was North Carolina or something, and this truck driver called in, and he was on a night shift, and he said, wow, this was before cell phones, he said, I had to pull over to a payphone and call. I've never heard anything about the things you're talking about, and I find it very interesting. Out there in the middle of the night, you know, communicating with a truck driver to the degree that he had to pull off the road. It made me so happy.
Holly Neer, thank you so much for joining us.
Take care.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And it's our spring fundraising campaign here on WKAR, a chance for you to support local reporting and local discussions, the likes of which you just heard, which was a really refreshing exchange between Melissa Benmark of WKAR and singer-activist Holly Neer. Those are the kinds of conversations I think you're becoming accustomed to here on Current State. If you value them, make a quick phone call right now, please, 517-353-5000, or visit us online at WKAR.org. Again, I'm Mark Bayshore with Current State producer Joe Lindstroth. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. That's right. If you value public radio and radio like Holly Neer, who just spent the last about minute or so of that interview talking about how much she loves radio and her ability to communicate with a truck driver in the middle of the night who pulled over to give her a call because he'd never heard the things that she was talking about. Those are the kinds of experiences I think a lot of folks have with public radio. They hear things that they just have never heard before. They find themselves just a little bit wiser. Maybe even if it's just to spark a conversation with your significant other or your friend at the end of the day because of something you've heard on public radio, that's value to your life. If you do find value in that, if you do find yourself learning something here as you tune to 90.5 every day, every other day, please give us a call and pledge what you can at 517-353-5000 or at WKAR.org.
Yeah, yes, Current State is here 3 times a day with Mid-Michigan issues and events, education reform, and elections, and budgets, and polls. Relevant, important issues you need to stay on top of, but right alongside those, stories about people, those people's stories, Holly Neer's candid perspectives on the changes in her life and what she's seen in the country over the decades of her her performing career. You heard the extraordinary tale of an area man who narrowly escaped with his life from Alaska on a hunting trip that went seriously awry. Stories like those, really human stories from our community very often, and those are what we seek to bring you on Current State. If that's of value to you, and you're listening now, so it must be of value to you, 517-353-5000 or WKAR.org. It's an important couple of weeks every year when we ask you to contribute. Now is that time. Please do so.
It really is. This is just a couple times a year where we come and ask for your support. And I want to just double back to what I was saying in an earlier break, that we did do a calculation, and with Current State a little over a year, more than 800 different conversations, segments that we brought you about this community, about Michigan, about our country, about our world to you. More than 800 with a skeleton crew. We've worked really hard to bring you a lot of content, but we are struggling against, we need more resources to help bring you more content, to bring you more in-depth stories and series. Please give us a call at 517-353-5000 or at WKAR.org. And I just want to touch also, Mark, on what you were saying about the variety of voices. We have this Neighbors in Action segment where we bring people who are working to make the community a better place, but we also bring in the folks who consume these services, who can bring you their first-person account, who live here in the community, who share with you what it's like for that person to struggle with a mental illness, for that person to struggle with poverty, for that person what their experience is like to struggle with a serious disability, and these organizations in the community that help them live full, independent lives. That is important content. That's an important thing we bring you to understand how everyone in this community, as many folks and viewpoints as we can, we try and bring you so you can understand your community better. If there's value to that, please give us a call. 517-353-5000, WKAR.org.
Make a contribution right now so Current State is alive and well and stays right here. 517-353-5000. That's our show for Thursday. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss Nordic walking. It's only the first day of spring. We'll be Nordic walking for months. Also, we'll have live music from Twyla Birdsong, that and more, tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth's our producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, to Aaron Young for engineering, and Libby Lussenhop for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.